Session number 11740, Lewis Hoskins, Reel 2.
Lewis Hoskins, Reel 2.
Americans, by and large, did not feel the keenness of hazard and risk and emotional involvement in the war. It was more intellectual rather than emotional. And that didn't mean that they were less or more tolerant of COs. They were not, but they were seeing their young men and coming back. So there was hostility, and also a great war industry had grown up, and many people were involved in that. And again, in our area, shipbuilding became a big operation in the Northwest. And again, shortage of manpower, and so the women were drawn into it. And for the first time in the Northwest, blacks, Negroes, were drawn in, if they were free of the draft, to help build ships. So in the Northwest, probably more than much of the country, we had the feeling of being involved and riskily involved in the war with Japan. And that probably heightened the criticism and the, I wouldn't call it persecution, but the lack of understanding and looking down on us as, if not traitors, at least not doing our share. But nothing like British young men faced, I suspect.
Right, so here you are then, arriving in China. Could you tell me about that?
Yes. We arrived in November of 1945 in Shanghai, and found Shanghai is a huge city, but in terrible condition, devastated in many parts, and with some Japanese still around in prison, and the city and the Chinese people struggling to come back on top of things again. They have tremendous resilience, but he had little wherewithal. Brunson and I, coming by ship, were able to bring in some medical supplies and equipment. We had to hang on to them very closely, or we wouldn't have gotten them through customs, because they would be so priceless out on the open market or the black market. But we did get them to our headquarters, and were almost immediately sent to our field work. Brunson was sent to the West China area, where, as you well know, the transport unit and the medical teams were still working in the West China area, roads and remote areas and clinics and hospitals. But I was sent to the Yellow River area, to our field station there that had moved, once the Japanese war ended, to Zhengzhou, and it became our headquarters for a time. And there we fanned out to rehabilitate hospitals that had fallen, had collapsed due to the occupation of the Japanese and sometimes the Chinese military, either the puppet Chinese or the Kuomintang National Army. We had to clear out the military in order to get the hospitals functioning again as the refugees, the Chinese villagers, came back from their displacement into West China and looking for their homes and wanting to get started again. Likewise, a tremendous backlog of medical needs, epidemics becoming endemic, and no equipment, no medicine, no doctors to mount anything in this area. There had been at least some military medical services in the West. Not very good, not adequate, which we can supplement, but as the people flooded back from the West, there was nothing. And it was also right where we deliberately chose to go, where, as a part of the war effort, the Yellow River dikes had been burst, had been opened up, so that the Yellow River flooded into a new path and devastated huge area, where it's called the flooded area. So we saw this as a medical and what is now called social and technical assistance, relief, resettlement task. And so that became our headquarters. by this time, the United Nations had been organized for relief in China, the United Nations Relief and Reconstruction Agency, or UNRWA as it was called, came in and as one of their first big tasks to redirect the Yellow River back in its proper channel by rebuilding the dikes. And we weren't involved in that, but very much attached to the unit because the international team of engineers who came to do that stayed in the same hospital compound that we had our field headquarters. But that, as soon as that was done, opened up huge areas for rehabilitation as the peasants came back to claim their land. Found it different, but wanting to go right back where they had been before. Shall I tell you a story about that? One time when we were there, a somewhat older refugee man, we'll call him Wong Xinxin, came up and asked us if we would be willing to help him resettle his family and his village. It was very near, he said. So we jumped into a jeep, and he sat up front with the driver, and he kept pointing the way to go over a flooded area that had nothing on it, just silt and not fertile silt. And he'd sight up a mountain there and a remnant of a tree there, and he'd line up with the sun. Finally, suddenly he said, "Stop here." And he pointed that this is where our village was. And so we marked the place and took back to our field headquarters. And within a couple of days, we were able to get a well digger out there and dug him a well. That's what it took. He couldn't have a village without a well. And very soon, with the well then, his family and his distant kin and his friends and relatives from far of that village clustered back and began rebuilding. Meantime, we had established a brick kiln for bricks and tile, and that would help them get started. So Wang Jia arose right where it had been before, now that it had water, and he began planting corn, maize, and discovered to his discouragement that this lovely level land now wasn't as fertile as it had been before, because while the Yellow River brings down less sand and soil, it doesn't bring much fertility with it. And he had been building for generations in that plot through the use of night soil and cultivation, the quality of his soil. And he had to start all over again on that. And so we could help him with seed and with some fertilizer occasionally. And UNRWA had given him a plow, but the plow had been designed by some expert who didn't know the Chinese system. And his bullock or his wife or whoever was going to pull the plow couldn't manage it. So we set up in our machine shop a new design according to the Chinese farmer's wish, that would fit their needs. And any time they would bring in an UNRWA plow, we would give him a Quaker plow. And we used whatever we could, munitions or anything to create into plows. And those seemed to work very well. And so the process of rebuilding and the villages to be rebuilding started up. We meantime brought in animals for breeding stock, and that would elevate the quality of their whatever stock they had, usually oxen. We bring in pigs and chickens as well. Then we diversified our effort. We had a hospital there in the middle of this flooded area that was now being rehabilitated, a very good field hospital, using the bricks and the tile that we had built on our in our brick kiln, and various other side products we were able to get from UNRWA, some Quonset huts which we used as storage so they could keep their grain during the peak period and into the time when they needed it badly. It would be well protected and well preserved into the winter. And a craft shop and various things of that sort. So it became, in my judgment, one of the very first village experiments in social and technical systems. This was in 1946, before Point Four, before AID and a lot of other things became common practice throughout the world.
How are you getting on with the other FAU members? You know, two people coming from America. I wonder how, what your relations were like.
We were upstart foreigners in a sense, but very quickly absorbed. And the team that I first, the medical team I was first involved in, was in Anyang or Jiangde, one of the ancient capitals of China. And there were seven of us, as I remember, New Zealanders who had joined the government now, Canadians who had come in after the Japanese had surrendered, and of course Chinese and Americans. So that it was a complete mix, and we were absorbed, I think, very comfortably into the structures, the governance of the FAU. As you well know, it was very democratic. Chinese members, absolutely indispensable to our judgments, were equal members with all of us in our deliberative sessions and the seeking of consensus or sense of the meeting. Was sometimes a little difficult in such diversity, but with a little patience, it worked out. There had been a stronger hierarchy than was emerging, and I don't know whether the Americans and the Canadians made a little contribution to that or not, but we were not as comfortable in uniforms, even though they'd be RCS uniforms, although we wore them because they're the warmest, most comfortable things to, and toughest to wear. So we wore them without adornment, just the FAU symbol and pin. But we weren't very comfortable with the head man being called a commandant, and we soon broke, I think, all of us by that time. Certainly the Americans were very uncomfortable with that. But the function of the council, the gathering, every so often to plan, make assignments, we had all agreed, no matter what background, on the principle of GADA, G-A-D-A, go anywhere and do anything, and therefore we might have preferred to do something else, but we went to do what was needed and accepted the judgment of the group without any difficulty. And as far as I could tell, there was no difference of judgment on nationality, only on skills, training, experience, abilities. And the teams worked remarkably well. So I certainly felt very comfortable from the very beginning. And I think most Americans, Canadians, New Zealanders did too. By that time, we were all somewhat newer because the old time British chaps, who might have been out of seniority and experience, higher in the hierarchy of authority, had to a great extent gone home, and younger ones were coming in, so we were all struggling to find a way to serve and to adapt to the challenges.
What would the political situation have been, you know, during this time when the Yellow River situation was being sorted out?
This was at the end of the Japanese War. The prior to the price of UNRRA serving, the United Nations serving in rehabilitation, and the diplomatic service was that there should be one nation. Most countries said that meant we'll deal with the national government, which was Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang. But they were usually saying in principle, but that doesn't mean we aren't concerned about the villagers and the peasants who live under the communists, and you must continue to work together. This had been a sore point for a long, long time, particularly out of Chungking, and it wasn't working very well. But there was not, at that moment when I arrived, any civil war. It was a temporary truce as they began to pick up pieces. It was evident in the fact that Americans were ferrying and flying Kuomintang soldiers to collect the surrendering Japanese equipment and prisoners rather than the communists. And the communists were racing to get some too. So the rivalry was there, but it was not a terribly vicious civil war until a little bit later. And as it became evident here, there, and everywhere, scattered, particularly in the Northwest, mistrust on both parts, but particularly on the part of Chiang Kai-shek, that the Americans decided to try one major effort to get them together in a coalition government. And this was the mission of General George C. Marshall, who had been, of course, the hero in Europe, knew very little about China, and came in with what seemed to the struggling FAU an enormous force to try and bring a coalition government together. This was in 46 and 47. General Marshall set up his headquarters in Nanjing and his field headquarters in Beijing at Peking, the Peking Union Medical College, the Rockefeller Hospital there, and called the two governments and military together and said, our first job is to stop these outbreaks, these fighting areas. Therefore, I have, I'll say, 50 colonels with their staffs. I want you to bring 50 nationalist colonels and you to bring 50 communist soldiers with their entourage, and we will set up these peace teams all over China where there's been a difficulty, and we'll stop the fighting, first of all. Then we'll go ahead and negotiate some sort of an arrangement, a coalition government of some kind. The first part of it worked, and it happened at Nanyang. We had one of those peace teams. So I got quite well acquainted both with the communists and the Kuomintang authorities, but also with America. The American colonel happened to come from Media, or very near the Pendle Hill where we lived, and known, so it was interesting. And they had logistical support, military support, and supplemental PX food, and this sort of other thing, which we were not loath to enjoy when invited. But we saw it it happening, and my own reaction at the time was optimistic, because at least the fighting was stopped. And that was, and then we could get on with our hospital. And we would hitch a ride when their plane came into Jiangdo and then flew up to Beijing. I did hitch up there once to Beijing in order to find what the Canadian missionaries and doctors had done with their surgical equipment. They had, on the way out, fleeing, taking some of the key surgical equipment and stored them in a Swiss warehouse or godown in Beijing. And I thought, well, there's a chance, maybe we'll see. And sure enough, after quite a little time, I found them and was able to bring them back to Jiangdo. But at the same time, this is partially afterthought. We could hear nothing about the political settlement. We tended to be heavily in the national government's area, because that's where we'd worked in the West, and it was national government south of the Yellow River and so forth. But very quickly we knew we were going to be caught up in any war that would erupt again. We had sent in the first medical team, the supplies, sorry, make it medical supplies into Yunnan from Chongqing, with some pressure on Chiang Kai-shek to permit it.
Was that the Tony Reynolds?
That's the Tony Reynolds story. And very soon after we arrived, we thought we ought to do what we could, first to find out what was needed, and then to do what we could in those areas that had also been fought over, now held by the communists. And we were wanting to be absolutely clear that we were non-political, non-military, and working for the village people according to the need, wherever we could. And so Bronson and I, to some extent, negotiated with General Marshall while he was still in Nanjing to fly in a Quaker medical team, an FAU medical team, to Yunnan. And he was glad to do so because he, too, was concerned to show concern, a balance in his humanitarian aspect of his task. And so at least two trips of medical supplies and personnel were flown into Yunnan through General Marshall's Air Force, support Air Force, I suppose you would say. It's a little hard to keep our sequence here, but I might just finish that story and then come back to the one I was more directly involved in. The team served relatively short time in Yunnan in a cave hospital because the Civil War eventually renewed and Yunnan became a major goal or target for the Kuomintang, and they began bombing Yunnan, and that particular team became a mobile medical team moving village to village over a number of months to keep ahead of the actual fighting and to protect their patients.
How easy was it to get that team set up and there? Did you have to work quite hard to persuade the Americans?
No.
To get planes and equipment? How about with all the supplies, for instance?
Well, that was much harder. But the principle of working on both sides was recognized by General Marshall. And so he was, as far as I can tell, I wasn't exactly at the center of the negotiations at that time. I was on the supply end because I had been called back to Shanghai to help collect materials and be personnel and the Shanghai agent. But that was relatively easy to secure. But then we had to scramble to find any supplies to support the team that could be flown in, because most of it had been siphoned off or directed to the national government's kind of support mechanisms, some military, some hospitals, and they were needing it too. So about the only place we could get medical supplies to fly into Yunnan, into the communist area, was from two sources. A little bit from the American Red Cross, kind of things they had in surplus, and then mostly from Madame Sun Yat-sen's China Welfare Fund. And that provided us with most of it. It wasn't always what we asked for, but we took what we could get on both of those trips in.
Mm. Was it difficult, would you say? Did the Kuomintang sort of put obstacles in your way? Were they sort of... did they go along with you helping the communists?
Not happily, and some were very against it. You could find in the Kuomintang hierarchy people who understood it, some of those who had to make the decisions were very loath to do it and would drag their feet, if not actually block it. So it took a lot of negotiating to do it, and Tony could remember some of the pressures there, which was supported, I think, probably by some of the diplomatic community on Madame Chiang Kai-shek and Chiang Kai-shek on that first trip. The later ones, I think General Marshall's prestige carried the way.
I was wondering also, I think, you know, around this time, didn't Lady Cripps take a mission to China? Was that involved in any way with this?
She was assessing the situation, visiting around, and there was a Quaker mission of Anna Brinton and Paul Sturge at the same time, assessing, this was in early 46, assessing what the situation was and what was needed and so forth. And we met the Kellips, as the Chinese called her, who came to Zhengzhou. I met Anna Brinton, Paul Sturge when I was in Beijing, and I think their presence was probably, without question, an influence, so that the Kuomintang doubters felt they had to go along in the public with Lady Cripps there. They couldn't say no. Other than that, most of our equipment supplies came from that time on, from the United China Relief of American Charity. We'd had some British Red Cross supplies. We'd commandeered a great deal as people withdrew, and as UNRWA handed over materials. So we were able to get our materials, a large part by scrounging wherever we could, particularly in the trucks and parts, spare parts in the West, and in this area, largely from UNRWA. By that time, some missionaries were coming back with some supplies to restore and equipment for their hospitals, but not much. We had to do most of that. We did 7 hospitals in the Yellow River area over a period of 2 or 3 years, plus our own that we built from scratch.
Am I right in thinking as well that the Medical Team 19, when they went up to Yunnan, the group that were soon to be on the move, did they take educational material as well? Am I right in thinking that that was included?
Not much.
No.
By very soon it came from the authorities, it wasn't really, and for some years, until the mass public health education carried out by the Ministry of Health was effective. By the time we got there later, it was very effective. But I don't remember including very much. Now, they obviously, as you heard the other day, Liz Hughes, in producing a baby in Yunnan, was a great educational tool for teaching the other Chinese women and the mothers about sanitation and child care and using not only cleanliness but using midwives and so forth. So there's an education component in all of our work, but it wasn't because we had literature and posters and things like that to any great extent. It was by demonstration.
Could I also ask you now about these people you've mentioned, General Marshall? Yeah. You know, what sort of a man he was, in your opinion? Because you obviously met him, as you explained.
We admired him, all of us who had anything to do with him, with a great deal of appreciation for his sincerity, his efforts, and his compassion. He quickly got onto the human catastrophe of the Chinese suffering, and wanted to end this war personally, I think, desperately himself. My own judgment on the mission was that America may have been wise or may have blundered to send in what was essentially a military effort, even though a non-active military. The presence of generals and colonels and support mechanisms had a psychological reminiscent for Chinese of former occupations by the West. And this was not Marshall's intention. But he was not seen as primarily as a mediator and as a diplomat. He was seen primarily as cracking down on them with force if need be to get together. And that gave for a good many Chinese, the wrong impression, I'm afraid. And if he had been able to halt the fighting as he did, and then transform his whole enterprise into a diplomatic effort, there's a slight chance he could have succeeded. But then international politics interrupted. And you had then to calculate, as Chiang Kai-shek and as Mao Zedong did, where help was going to come for their internal goal of winning the people over for their side. Zhang for the national government, the Kuomintang party, and his goals, and Mao for his liberation and communist goals. And both were looking over the world for that kind of help. And that leads on to some very interesting debates and discussions we got into as Marshall withdrew and the war heightened. And he did, as you remember, give up and set a plague on both of your parties. You won't get together, you don't trust each other, you won't cooperate. I see no hopes of doing anything. We just as well go home. And he did. And the war